it's Laura. Welcome to another episode of Future Tripping. This week, I have the joy of being in conversation with Robin Brulé. Robin is a Senior Director of Philanthropic Partnerships at Filene. She is an Annie E. Casey Foundation Fellow and has been recognized with a Spotlight on Poverty Award, as well as a Harvard Ash Innovation Award. Robin is also a fierce advocate for common sense gun safety reform, having lost her 75-year-old mother several years ago to gun violence. I have had the privilege of knowing Robin for years and wrote about her in The Age of Overwhelm. I am truly grateful to have her with us today. Just a reminder that we'd love to hear from you, and if you have any questions for us, you can find us on our site at traumastewardship.com and through Instagram at Future Tripping with Laura. Welcome to another episode of Future Tripping. Today, I have the privilege of being in conversation with Robin Brulé. Robin, thank you for joining us.
It's really my pleasure and honor. Thank you.
Robin, we met each other in the aftermath of an indescribable tragedy when your mother had been murdered. I'm wondering if you would be willing to share with us a bit about your mom and her life and anything that you want to share with us about her death.
Sure. I'd be happy to. I want to start by saying my mother was one of the most generous, thoughtful people I knew and really believed that we could do better as a society in how we treat one another and really how we lift our communities up and make sure that people are able to thrive and get what they need. And she taught me so much about this kind of work, which is why I do what I do today. She was a teacher in a very, very, very under-resourced part of town. Lots of families and kids who were struggling with a lot of things. And we, as children, grew up volunteering at food banks and homeless shelters and other places because we were taught from a very early age that you have to give back, you have to be a good human, and that life is also about service. So I say all that because that's where I came from and chose to have a career really working on economic inclusion and really trying to find different solutions to ending poverty and ending violence. So my mom was very active human, 75 years old, was still walking with friends and being and volunteering at schools and being part of book clubs and traveling all over the country. She had lost my dad. We had lost my dad a couple years earlier, and that was really hard for her. They had been married over 50 years. And so she decided one of the things she was going to do was visit friends all over the country. And she visited her old friend in Arizona, and she went out to stay a few days with her in a really lovely part of Arizona that of course, was supposed to be this very safe retirement community. And three people came into the home at 8 o'clock in the morning while my mom was reading a newspaper and drinking her coffee. And they shot my mom and her friend point blank just to steal their credit cards and their cash and murdered both of them and drove off. And the way my brother, sister, and I found out about it is my mom, of course, was visiting this friend. And my mom was very orderly. Like, she did everything by process. And so when she didn't check into her Southwest flight, we knew something was going on. When she didn't make a lunch date that she was supposed to have because we all had her itinerary, we knew something was going on. And thank goodness, my brother also, who was responsible for helping her monitor her account, saw some really strange activity happening. So we ended up calling the Arizona Police Department. They did a wellness check, and they found them both murdered. And that's how I met you, because I knew for me to try to figure this out and move forward on a daily basis and also try to emulate love and joy and hope and the things I want to be grateful for in my life, but also dealing with this terrible trauma and tragedy and violence. I couldn't wrap my head around it, and I really, really knew I needed to have trauma support, real trauma support.
Robin, of course, there are no words for a loss like this. And thank you for sharing with us everything you are. Can you say anything more that you would like to about what it was like in the aftermath of her death and what your path was coming out of that?
Yeah, I mean, I look back now, and the two words I hold on to are patience and permission. I didn't give myself a whole lot of patience or permission to feel the way I was feeling, and I literally felt like I was going to fall down on the floor and not get up again. I was so overwhelmed. I felt terrorized by the way they were murdered. I felt terrorized that these people literally walked into their home at 8 a.m. in the morning and killed them point blank. I felt terrorized that, you know, where are you supposed to, you know, people always say wrong place, wrong time. How is your home? How is your school? How is your place where you worship? Wrong place, wrong time. Like, that's not okay. So that grappled me, that underlying feeling of safety and security. So really understanding that I needed safety and security more than ever. So little things would make me crazy. and I had to learn to realize it. So like, I'd be out at a restaurant and somebody would, I don't know, be rude to the waiter or waitress or skip the line. And it triggered me, like, really terrified about this behavior. And I realized it's because they were not operating in a safe and secure manner. They were not following the rules. So folks who were so-called not following the rules in our society became a real huge trigger for me. Being at my home became a trigger for me. I didn't feel safe in my home anymore because I started imagining all these things. Like, if this happened to my mother, it could happen to anyone in any town, in any place, no matter where you're living. And so that really stuck with me. I ruminated all the time about what she experienced in her last moments. I made up stories in my head about what she knew was happening or not. To this day, I don't know all the circumstances because I cannot manifest that. So my sister and my brother were, operated differently, and they found out more facts about specific details, which I still can't digest. Mm-hmm. I found it very hard to keep my friendships, not because I didn't love my friends, but I really just couldn't interact with people. And it was hard to be married and be a mother. Also, because I felt so guilty that I couldn't provide, I wasn't me anymore.
Mm-hmm. 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 And what did you find to be comforting on any level, bring you any sense of solace, bring you any sense of, and I don't use this word lightly, you know, when we suffer a loss of this magnitude, we can feel like we are absolutely losing our minds. So sense of sanity, what did you find to be of assistance in any way?
For me, it was being very sarcastic with my humor, which I'm sure some people didn't appreciate. I like really was blown away by all the different processes and procedures we had to deal with in the legal system. Mm-hmm. I am grateful that law enforcement ended up catching the perpetrators. And at the same time, dealing with that system is very interesting and complex and brings up a lot of emotions as well. So if I'd call these hotline or helplines, you know, I'd make up these stories in my head like, oh, you know, if your mom was just a victim of murder and homicide, press one. Like, nobody finds that funny but me, but I thought that was very funny. Because it's like, call it like it is. Like, we're having to deal with some real stuff. The other thing that I did is I wrote letters constantly to my mom. You know, I would talk to her out loud and then write down the experiences, and it helped me. And then I had I had a circle of very close people to me that I would share my thoughts and feelings with sort of in real time. Mm-hmm. And it was the way I could process it. And then I was really clear with myself that it was okay that I didn't know some of the things, and it was okay that if I ever become ready, I'll mm-hmm. do it, but I don't need to do that. Mm-hmm. I would say last is trying to really think about how I could honor my mom mm. and how to come from a place of love and joy and hope, which is what she would always want. And my mom, so the other thing my sister and I would do is we would make up these stories in our head. My mom had this really thick New York accent, and we could see her like coming back as a ghost and telling the detectives, don't tell them what happened. Tell them it was a gas leak. I don't want them to worry. So we'd make up these stories about how our mom would want to protect us from this terrible thing that happened, and she wouldn't want it to impact the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, talking to you, and I don't mean that. I mean that with heart and gratitude, because I don't think, as much as we all want to be friends and supporters of people who are going through extreme anguish and trauma, I don't think it's always known how to do that mm-hmm. and help people walk through and navigate those feelings, because they're enormous. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Robin, one of the things that I so admire about how you have moved through space and time is the insight you've had about, you might say you didn't know what you needed, and still there was a way that I think you did really listen to what your body was telling you, your instincts were telling you, your mind was telling you. And the integrity with which you moved through the aftermath of it, being true to yourself, and also you did make some choices about joining the larger advocacy movement out there of public health safety, common sense, gun control and reform, however one wants to call it. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure, and thanks for asking. Interestingly enough, or maybe not so interestingly, because my mother was a public school teacher, gun violence was something that we talked a lot about in our household for various reasons, especially when my mom started to be subjected to drills on how to keep safe if there was an active shooter in the building. And she worked in a school where there was a lot of gun violence that took place in the neighborhood and the community, unfortunately, and that kids and she was subjected to. So, like, it became something that we talked about, again, like, where are you safe? Where are you safe? And what can be done, recognizing this is a complex issue, and people get really charged up when they talk about it, because it's often tied to the Second Amendment, which I respect. And I still think, though, that we can have different kinds of legislation that help us to keep us safe and sound while you can still exercise your rights. A friend of mine lived, my college roommate lived in the Sandy Hook area, and was around for that horrendous attack on those children. And so this was something I had been involved in at some level for quite some time. And then, of course, when it happened in my mom, I really asked folks who were in the movement, like, how can I how can I be helpful? What would be the most helpful for me to help really utilize my network to help support, you know, different kinds of legislation or why it's important? And they said, you know, the best thing that you could do is, we don't have a lot of survivors who will share their story and share it openly. And so that's how I chose to honor my mom, is to share her name. I never wanted her to be known as a victim. I wanted people to understand what happened and how our family was experiencing it, and that there are things that can be done to minimize these kind of events. And I firmly believe, and the statistics show, that they do not take away people's rights. In fact, most gun owners, legal gun owners who are polled, believe in background checks or believe in registering. So I think we've gotten really distorted on, you know, who doesn't want these laws changed and really what it means. And for goodness sake, it was harder to get like Cynaid or other kinds of prescription or non-prescription drugs for like sinus infections that are often used in the creation of meth than it was to get a gun in my state. So like, you had to show your license, you had to go to the drugstore, you can only buy a certain amount of boxes or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And it just like blew my mind that we as a society are willing to be proactive in what people can, like we did it with seatbelts, and we did it with drunk driving, and we did it with, oh, you can't buy certain kinds of medicines because you will use them for illicit behavior, but we won't do it with guns. And we've seen this increase in violence in places that are, it's not acceptable. I don't believe there's any wrong place at wrong time, but that fact that children are being murdered in schools, people are being murdered in their place of worship, people are being murdered and shot down in parking lots and shopping malls. Like, let's stop and think. We are the only country that seems to not be able to find a solution to this challenge. And we just create these lines in the sand of where we will or will not go with it. And that's just incomprehensible to me, no matter what it is.
Right. And Robin, what would you say to folks who find themselves going through the earlier days of a loss like this, both for folks who are engaged in the legal system and not engaged in the legal system, because I know that adds an additional layer. Anything that you would want to share from what you have been through and what you learned?
Yeah. Well, one, again, patience and permission. So I gave myself a lot of really messed up messages. Like, if you don't get on this phone call with this prosecutor, you're in denial, or you're not strong enough to hear what they want to do, or you're not advocating for your mother, and that's not helpful. So what I would say is, don't give yourself a message around anything except that a terribly traumatic thing happened, and it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of space to work through that. And whatever you're feeling in that moment, it's really okay. It doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't make you a lazy person. It doesn't make you a person who can't handle things. None of that's accurate or true. The second thing I would say is, utilize resources if they're available to you. So for me, in the state where my mom was murdered, they happened to have a very good victim support program and a lot of services for families and individuals who are associated with violent crimes and murders. And it was very helpful to me to have like third party folks helping us navigate the complexity of the legal system and the justice system, and them doing some of the front work for me, for my family, in ways that I didn't have to, and then sharing information about what our rights were. I utilized all those things. I also tried really hard to, and this was also by my coaching from you, is keep active. drink a lot of water because I remove that from my body. And when I started thinking about it that way, it really made sense to me. Like, I'm carrying so much and so much is churning around. I have to move that through my body. So I really need to drink a lot of water, and I need to move, and I need to sweat it out. And at first I was really cranky about that. And then I ended up loving it. And I still love it to this day because it's like a meditation space for me. That's my place to go to get out all the toxins. It's not just about my physical health, which is important. It's about my mental health and my spiritual health. So that became a really strong thing for me. And then don't let anybody narrate how you should feel. You know, I had people can be really screwed up in these kind of situations, and they tell you things and, you know, they think they're being helpful, but it was very triggering to me. And that's actually is to this day is like, have you forgiven the people who did this? Well, one, that's none of your business. And second of all, like, you know, I don't want to talk about that with you. It's, right. That's really hard. Or, well, you know, we all have to go sometime, and she lived a really good life. I'm like, what? We all have to go sometime. Okay, that's really helpful. Like, yeah, of course we all have to go sometime. I'd prefer to do it in my sleep and not be murdered in a violent homicide and a home invasion. Like, you know, not so good. Or I think moving on is triggering for me, that phrase moving on. I think you move forward, but I carry this with me every single day of my life. And every year I find that it manifests in myself differently than it did those first 3 months, the first year, and other things. So that's the other thing, is that it's like an ocean. Sometimes it's really wavy and strong, and then other times it's sort of calm and you can float in the water.
Thank you so much.
And don't eat a lot of sugary foods. don't help at the end.
One of the things that I think you found some comfort in was animal-assisted therapy, both during the trial and since then. So for folks who can relate to that or appreciate that or might not know about that, would you be willing to share a bit about that?
Absolutely. Saved my life. And, you know, that's one of the services that was offered in the state where where the murders happen, is they have a really great support service and a network of support. And one of those things is service dogs in the courtroom. And so I remember contemplating with you on several occasions, do I go to the court? Do I listen? What parts do I not listen to? Do I look like a coward if I run out of there? You know, I want to project to the jury that we care about my mom. You know, all these things running through my head. And then also being really, really stressed out and exhausted and emotional being there and hearing some of the things I was hearing. And so they were like, well, we have service dogs. We can bring the service dogs in. They'll just sit with you the entire time. So these three dogs literally were the thing that calmed me. They'd come. They'd sit with me every single day. They'd sit on my feet. And I learned that that's a grounding experience. So they're putting pressure on your feet. So they're reminding you, you know, you're here. You're anchored. You're okay. You don't have to disassociate. And I became a big fan of service dogs. Always was anyway, because I used to work in a hospital and saw what therapy dogs did for people. But I became a true believer in what I needed for my healing. And so after the court experience, I told my husband, I need a service dog. I need a PTSD service dog. Like the difference it made in my life and my ability to deal with my emotions and my fear and anxiety was huge. And at first he was like, do we really need another pet? Like, I really want to support you. And like verbal, you know, we already have dogs and cats. I'm like, no, I really need a dog who is trained in this kind of trauma level support. So I think it's really different. And I applied and I got a beautiful dog about a year and a half after I made that decision. And she was trained by a woman who trains PTS dogs for for people coming out of all kinds of situations. And she changed my life at home. In fact, I don't think I would be able to be in my home alone, even to this day, without having her and knowing that she's part of my circle of help and navigation. So I'm a big fan. What makes me sad is that they're hard to get. Mm-hmm. They're waiting lists, and sometimes people have a hard time navigating that system too. They can be very costly. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't have the resources or the networks, like find somebody, I'll help you. I will help you navigate that because I absolutely believe in it. And there's different kinds of ways that you can raise the funds to do it. And it changed my life.
Thank you, Robin. One of the things I want to ask you to speak to, if you're willing, is I know so many folks, when they survive a tragedy, they expect of themselves that they somehow engage in efforts around trying to prevent future tragedies of that regard. So whether it is drunk driving, whether it is sexual assault, whether it is climate-related disasters, any number of things, I think we as humans, as you were referencing, can tell ourselves, you know, this is the right, there can be a lot of rigidity in our minds, and we can tell ourselves, this is the right course, this is how you honor the person, and we can be really, really harsh with ourselves. Sometimes involving ourselves in those circumstances can be healing. There's not anything inherently healing about doing that. It's a larger conversation we talk a lot about around trauma mastery. Sometimes it can be healing, but it's not inherently healing. And certainly doing something from a place of obligation in the aftermath, whether it's 2 weeks after or 2 years after, can be really harmful. So anything you'd be willing to share in terms of what you told yourself, how you talked to yourself around that, and what you might share with anyone else who is struggling with that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm a high-functioning person, and what I mean by that is no matter how crappy or lousy or depressed or anxious I'm feeling, I feel like I have to show up, which is terrible. It's a terrible thing to do to somebody, to yourself, because there are days where you don't have to show up. You don't have to make that meeting. You don't have to go to work. And I mean this sincerely. Like, yeah, you got to figure out your long-term obligations, but give yourself some space and grace around this. And I didn't. And so I felt very obligated to go to work. I felt very obligated to do all the activities I had been doing in the past. I would cry to doing any kind of normal activity. So my husband and I used to be really great moviegoers with our family. We'd always have family Friday night movie night. And I couldn't go for like 4 months. And then when I did go, I cried. And my experiences were always like, my mom doesn't get to do this anymore, or I shouldn't be enjoying myself, or how could I do anything that's normal when this terrible, terrible thing that has happened? And like, I gave myself all kinds of messages around that. And I think we have to act a certain way, and we have to participate in certain things. And I just hope that everybody can hold on to their own experience and do what's right for them. I wish now, looking back, I had laid in bed for a week and allowed myself to do that, because I honestly couldn't even deal with information coming into my head. I couldn't have any kind of conversations. I just had a hard time even navigating time and space. It just became crazy making to me. So the things I did to push myself during that time period are not healthy. They weren't healthy. And I hope that others are lighter and gentler and really kind and gentle to themselves and not give themselves those trips about what they should be doing or how they should be showing up or what they should be acting like, because there's no norm in this.
Thank you, Robin. Consistent with how your mom raised you and the values you grew up with and what was important to her, you now find yourself doing work that is connected, even if not, you know, directly in the way that some folks might think of it. So will you share with us a little bit about your current work and how you chose to do this work?
Sure. It's super ironic to me, and sometimes I laugh at it, and other times I'm like, what the heck am I doing? But my mother especially was very focused on poverty and what that looked like and the implications it has for families, individuals, society, et cetera. And so I became uber focused on that. And so my body of work over my professional career has really been trying to figure out different kinds of ways to take asset-based holistic approaches to moving people out of poverty in all kinds of ways. And part of that is because I believe it's possible, even though it's complex. And I also think that economic struggle creates violence. I'm not saying I condone that violence or think it's an excuse. I don't. But I think it's part of what happens in a society, unfortunately, which is very sad. And so my work has been around trying to understand the intersections of financial institutions and capital systems with other systems like education, workforce development. So I work on innovative, literally, financial products and services that take into account real people's lives and experiences and how they relate to a capital environment. And that may sound like, I don't even know what you're doing, lady. What does that even mean? But that means, like, when I was going through my divorce a long time ago, I was stressed out about money and credit, and I could barely walk into a financial institution and talk about what was happening because I felt like the person around the counter was just going to tell me, your credit sucks. I don't care how much you make. There's no way it can help you. And it terrorized me for that time period. So then I think about people who have struggles way larger than that, not that divorce isn't a struggle, but the trauma that is inflicted, the trauma that we internalize around money, the trauma and shame we internalize around money, and then the real traumatic situations that people have, like through economic coercion. So my work now is focused on trauma-informed financial services, and that simply means, how do we do things differently and better to get people what they need, especially in emergency situations? Because if not, they can't leave. So if you think about domestic violence or intimate partner violence, you hear all these people like, well, why don't you just leave? Why don't you walk out? In 99% of domestic violence and intimate partner violence, there is economic coercion. So it's not just about having whatever, the superpowers or the strength or the will or the desire to leave. It's literally you cannot. Your whole financial existence is wrapped around this person. So how do we, or an abuser, so how do we find ways to mitigate that, and where can the financial services sector partner with other organizations to find solutions?
So for folks for whom this is new information, understanding certainly the financial factors that can be there, the economic abuse that can be present in relationships that are controlling, manipulative, unhealthy, abusive, can you say a little bit more about what are the resources currently available and how are systems trying to help? So a bit more about what your work looks like.
Sure. So I am specifically working with partners around domestic violence and intimate partner violence. And there are a lot of resources available to individuals and families who are in that situation to help them to remove themselves from the situation. But what keeps, what is excluded a lot of times from the help that is given is financial support. Mm-hmm. And the financial support is literally the number one thing that people need to leave. And so my work is figuring out different ways to provide that financial support to individuals that isn't just emergency funding based or or grant-based because there's not enough grants to go around to support people this way, but to change the way we think about this and to fill in the gaps and where the financial sector can fill in the gaps. So an example is if I was living in that kind of situation and I needed to get out and I needed 3 months' rent, but my credit was sucky because this person had stolen my identity and created all kinds of charges, like I could get a relationship-based microloan that doesn't pull my credit, that doesn't ask for collateral, that doesn't make my abuser aware that I'm dealing with the financial sector. And I would get that microloan and I would be given a period of time to pay it back that's probably different than the terms that we have today. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have to go to a payday lender and put myself in a worse situation. So those are the kinds of things I'm working on, is how do we get people access to what they need and do it in a way that meets their needs without saying, hi, you know, I'm Rob and I'm living in a domestic violence situation. I'm going to need this loan. And oh, by the way, you can't pull my credit. Can't do these things. Like, those aren't conversations that happen. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. For folks who aren't involved in this work and in this field and who are really interested in that, want to be of help, is there a way that folks who aren't involved in the field can be of help with that?
Yeah. You know, there's an organization called Free From that I think is amazing. And they have really, they support individuals who are leaving violent situations, intimate partner violence. And they recognize, or they have recognized over the years, like it's like anything else. We have all these services for folks. And then we're like, but how come it's not working? It's because you haven't solved the gap or thought of everything that needs to be connected. And so they've recognized that financial coercion, economic coercion is the number one reason folks stay in violent situations, violent relationships. So their whole work is about how can we provide different services or strengthen services that are being provided to individuals in these situations that address that issue as well. And how do we do it in a way that actually alters the way financial institutions respond or proactively support these kind of individuals? So again, if you have lousy credit or if you're in a violent situation or both, you are not going to walk into a financial institution and ask for help. And if you do, you're probably not going to get what you need. I'm sad to say that because of the way we score credit and the way we collateralize people. So we have to come up with different measurements of how to get people what they need without taking those protocols we live by right now. And a lot of people would call me crazy and say, well, we have a credit system for a reason and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, we've proven over and over again that you can have different kinds of factors and they work.
Okay, so Free From is an organization that folks could check out. Any additional ways that folks could help, even as is true with so many of these topics, the way we talk about things differently or encourage other folks to think about things differently, what do you think people don't understand around this? And are there ways that we can weave some of that insight into our day-to-day life?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's just like trauma, right? It is trauma. So we never know what somebody else is going through, and we give ourselves all kinds of messages about what we should be doing, what others should be doing, and we make all kinds of assumptions on why people are in certain situations, and we make up narratives of why they stay in them or in them. And oftentimes we don't have all the information and have all the facts. So the number one thing I would say is your assumptions are not always correct, and you don't know what somebody is walking in, and like, if you could let that down a little, that'd be great. The second thing is domestic violence and intimate partner violence is a life and death situation. And it also includes children many times. And so there are lovely, great organizations out there that provide support services. But I can tell you in one of the states we're working in, Texas, 70% of folks who called who needed a bed couldn't get one because the rates are so high of people needing shelter and to get out. So donate to those organizations. That's one thing you can do. You could also look, and I know you mentioned Free From, but they have all these really great things that they've been doing, like providing emergency grants and other kinds of financing methods for folks who are trying to get out. And I would say educating yourself about the challenge that people are having and really trying to think from a different place on the construct they're stuck in. If somebody is coercing you economically, they are controlling every single aspect of your life, literally, and you don't have a dime or a cent on you and you have no place to go and get it. So I'm just going to use myself as an example. I have three kids. Am I going to put them in car and drive down to the homeless shelter and hope I get a bed? And where am I going to stay the next day? Like, these are big things, and they're not easily solved. So we have to come up with some better options for people.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Second to last question, to whatever degree you're willing to share, I think you could offer some really important insight and just thoughts for folks here. You have lived a couple places that one might say the majority of folks around you do not share many or most of the same values that you hold to be very important. And I think over the last several years, there has been increased tension in so many people's relationships in their lives of, this is where I've spent time, or this is where I've grown up, and it has been okay, or wonderful, or fabulous, and now it's less so because things are changing so much, and I'm no longer in alignment values-wise with my neighbors, or folks in this community, or leadership of this state. And obviously, not everybody wants to move and leave. And of course, not everybody can move and leave. And I'm having more and more conversations with folks who are trying to figure out if the leadership where I live or the majority of folks around me where I live and I are really not coming from the same place. What does it mean to stay here? And number one, just be okay myself in terms of mind, body, spirit, all of that and all the different manifestations of that. And then also, if I'm staying here, how might I be able to be of assistance and not go to this really reductionistic place of us versus them, good, bad, that binary. So anything you're willing to share there, given your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I put myself in a lot of us versus them spaces by choice because I chose to share my story with folks who were opposed to what I was asking them to do. And I've had people tell me that I've testified before Congress, and I've had people in the congressional floor tell me that it was a circus of drama. And it's like, this is my story. It's not a circus. Yes, it is dramatic. It's very dramatic, but it's real. And how else am I supposed to share this with you if I don't tell you that my mother and her friend were shot point blank at 8 a.m. in the morning? That happened. And I am asking you to think about doing things differently. And I recognize that you are coming from a different place than me, but I'm also asking you to figure out a way that we can try to make things different and operate differently. So when I choose to put myself in that situation, and I also recognize what it's going to do for me. Like after that happened, that event, which I wanted to do, I was checked out for a couple days. It was really stressful. Living in places where a lot of the community and the public, the government officials don't align with my views, and some like really hurtful views in my estimation, I have tried to flip my narrative around So it's even more important that I'm here and I'm using my voice, because oftentimes your voice can get squelched when you feel like you're the few versus the many, and you feel like you're not part of the group, or that you're saying something that's different than the rest of them. And that can be scary and frightening. And we've gotten to a place where we are so cruel to one another and things that are being said. So also, like, diplomacy and the ability to negotiate or feel gone. So I try to remember I can connect to groups and organizations that have the same values and beliefs that I do, that I think are doing really good work, and that's how I can contribute. And that's also where I can share my frustration, my fear, my tension, whatever it is. And I choose very deliberately not to share with certain people. I choose very deliberately not to make my positions known in certain places, simply because I don't want to have the stress of that kind of confrontation, because it triggers me all the way back to the day my mom was murdered. So I hope people can see themselves as an instrument of change, and however they want to change the world, and know that they can provide service and partnership with organizations or others who are working on a cause they care about in a way that's, it's meaningful, and they don't feel like they're spiraling and nothing's ever going to change.
Right, right. Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Robin. Last question. We always try to offer listeners some really concrete strategies when they're feeling overwhelmed and moving through overwhelm. Can you share with us anything you're willing that you feel to be non-negotiable in your life in terms of regular practices that you employ that help you sustain?
And you know, and this kind of goes back to your, some of your earlier questions about what kind of got me through or what I was thinking about. And I'm a kind of person who has to reflect on things. So tomorrow I'll be calling you with all this stuff and we won't be talking, but I really try to make sure the people who are in my life that are important to me know that they are important to me and that I love them. I really try on a daily basis to be okay with who I am and what I've experienced and where I am in the moment and voicing what I need. So I can give you a great example of that. My husband sometimes doesn't lock the front door. That makes me crazy. I used to scream at him about it. Now I don't scream at him about it. I used to say, do you understand what this means to me? And he'd be, of course, yes, I love you. And he's the greatest husband ever, but stuff happens. So now I try to just be like, honey, can you help me with this? Because it really causes this kind of stress in me, and try to negotiate and ask for the things I need to feel safe and secure. And also ask the people around me to try to respect that as much as they can, recognizing they don't live in the same mental space that I do. And then, like, really trying to find things to be grateful for on a daily basis, even if they're the littlest things. And trying to emulate the very best parts of my mother, because the most important thing to me was that she's not a victim. She's not unknown. Her name is Ruth. She's a mother, grandmother, community activist, volunteer, teacher, friend, mentor. And that legacy goes on. She made a huge impact in the world. And violence cannot erase her. And now when I talk about that, I actually feel hope and joy, whereas in before it just made me really cry. And I don't know if that makes sense to you, but
exquisite. Thank you, Robin. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for everything I've learned from you over the years. Thank you for who you are in my life. Thank you for gifting many different movements with your presence. And of course, it is not lost on me that having conversations like this, that there are consequences in terms of just the toll it can take to even go back there and remember and share. So I just want you to know how much I appreciate you and how grateful I am that you took the time to join us today and went to the effort. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
It's really my privilege and it's really my honor. And you're one of the people in my life that saved me. And I truly mean that. And I voice that because one of the things I learned is find those people that can help anchor you and navigate you through these experiences. And they'll keep altering and people that you can trust to at least just even voice how you feel and not feel shame or judgment around that is really important.
Our podcast, Future Tripping, is a Trauma Stewardship Institute production. I, Laura, am your host and producer. Our incredible executive producer and sound engineer is Olivia P. Sunier, without whom this podcast would not be possible. It's edited and mixed by Tom Stiles, with original music by Cameron DeVore. Our graphic designer is Evie Burrows-White. Thank you for downloading and subscribing, and, as always, please give us a holler with any questions or suggestions. We can be found at traumastewardship.com and on Instagram at FutureTrippingWithLaura. There you can find both an email and phone number where you can ask your questions of our upcoming guests. I am grateful you joined us. Please remember, however your overwhelm is feeling today, you're not alone. You're in good company, and I look forward to being with you here on Future Tripping again next week.